Okay.
Given, this is not exact in the book because I didn't write it down. I didn't bring it with me, but this is as I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
The important part, I think I remember. It says, soil history, then it's in parentheses, all changes, is made by those few seers, the parentheses, gophers and monkeys, who escape here and there from the state of blindness to the top.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
Who said that, do you know?
The name is James Harvey Roberts, and I think I was going to email it.
James Harvey Roberts. I think he did some work on the Gnostic Gospels.
Yeah.
I think so.
Did he?
The only book I can find, I just think it's in the library, it's making up mind or something. I don't know if this is from that. That's what happened. Can you read it one more time? I was working with papers and couldn't concentrate on two things. So, all changes, which is all changes, is made by those few seers, and then it's different, gophers and monkeys.
Who escape here and there from the sacred blindness.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's people who are groping and monkeying around, trying to find.
Yeah.
And there's a line in here. There are no paved ways into the future. Page 299. Paved. There are no paved. I think it's saying the same thing in different words. There are no paved ways into the future.
Page
299. We'll be getting there, but it's in the same spirit.
I mean, this is bringing out so much of how hard it is to read, how difficult, I mean, how you are alienated, and how you have to speak against the spirit of the time. Yeah.
Which hates you for it, even though you are contributing to its well-being. That's the irony.
In the element of, they think it's
sinful. Yeah. And you're accused of being a heretic.
Yeah.
Or unpatriotic or whatever.
I'm
heretic,
yeah. I mean, I don't think, I'm looking at the pews going up in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's sad, huh?
Oh,
Yeah, I'm just sort of disassociating. I mean, dealing with this phenomenon of mobbing, which is kind of new. Have you followed that?
Mobbing.
It's when a group, it basically it's at work, picks out one person to scapegoat them.
Oh, yes.
And the way it works is the ringleader stays in the background and gets, and generally it's the boss or some boss, gets the employees to start hassling the employee. And what was so interesting, they're now passing legislation, because it drives some people crazy against it. And what the studies have shown is the one they pick out is the most competent, you know, the most efficient, the best worker, the one who sees what's going on, what's wrong with the company, and then that's the one they go after. It's very similar. It's bullying, but where bullying is one person against another, the bully hides in the background and creates a de facto committee to slowly mess with the mind of the...
Organized bullying.
Organized bullying, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Subversive.
I think I'm dealing with a woman in a corporate setting who has said this and this and this is why we're not doing well. Suddenly, she's been called on the carpet, she's been written up, and what's the word they call use for, like, you're on probation? Because you made this mistake, this mistake, this mistake, this mistake, and these have all been reported. Yeah. Everyone else makes those mistakes. Yeah. And they're not reported. Mm-hmm. See how that works? And it's awful. But it's this whole idea that the person who knows what's best and who's pointing toward the future is attacked.
That happens in families, too.
And I guess it happens in families, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And generally, I think it's because the boss is threatened.
Yeah. And it's a typical of dysfunctional organizations. The more dysfunctional the organization, the more it mobs. Or more it picks a scapegoat, be the old language for it.
That's encouraging because when they got rid of my job at the church, I must have been the most. I mean, I knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're threatened. And when they know that, you know, someone will come out and go against the
status quo,
and you're not, you know, if you being the scapegoat, mm-hmm. you're not just going along with everything,
mm-hmm.
you protest or else you point a different way, that is really, I guess, because all, you know, most of the leadership really isn't leadership. You're not just fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And you fit in and support the status quo. Looks mm-hmm.
Which means mediocrity, which is mm-hmm. the organization.
And boy, they'll probably, I mean, you know, that because you have to, because anymore people have to, you really have to document. I mean, legally,
mm-hmm.
you have to document if you're going to fire anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, they're just going to get more roundabout about it.
Mm-hmm.
More,
yeah, all the paperwork's there.
You know, mm-hmm. is to just make up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they just make up stuff mm. about you to substantiate that.
Or they make it so uncomfortable. With.
Yeah, that's the point. Mm-hmm. And yeah. it messes with your head.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
I have heard that, mobbing.
Yeah, mobbing. Google it. It's I think there's legislation in... pending in half the states, I think. And Washington's got a big test case coming. State of Washington has a big test case coming up before the courts, I believe.
Mobbing, that's the term for what some birds do. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All the little birds will mob a big threatening bird,
right.
like a raptor of some kind, mm-hmm. a crow or a hawk or mm-hmm. all the little sparrows, all the little birds. They're fast and quick, and they can all just get in and poke and scream and yell at them. Finally, it drives them away. It messes with their minds. It works. Keeps them away from their nest.
Yeah. Well, quick review. Let's just look at what we did last time and then put it in context of what we've been doing. I think it will help make sense. I was feeling very confused the last couple of weeks, and I realized the reason I get confused is the material is confusing. And I also think I figured out something else. When one gets confused with this level of material, by level I mean deep, look ahead. And so I've looked ahead, and I think I now can put it in context. I think it helps to see where we're going. We get all of this confusing stuff, and you think, what in earth is there a way to make sense of this? And the only way to make sense of it is to see where it's headed. And so let's review last week, I'll try to put it in context of where we've been and where we're headed. I hope it'll make some sense. Basically, last week we talked about the ancestors. How what Jung is how what Jung is working with is a return to past truths. He doesn't know what to make of that at this point. What we'll see is these past truths have to be respected on the one hand, and on the other, a new level for their application has to be found. They simply can't be ignored, and they also can't just be brought up and repeated. And you might say, now what's that mean? Well, hang on, we'll see how he does that. But it's just occurring to him, I am being assaulted by truths from the past. And, you know, I can tell you, at least from my time in the Peace Corps, and some of you others of you, I'm sure, have had the experience, how primal cultures honor the dead. These little villages in Korea, now not the modern ones, but the ones with no electricity and still that were built around wells with thatched roofs, like they must have been, they hadn't changed in 5,000 years, were all surrounded by burial mounds. And boy, you never insult an old person. You insult an old person, you're dead. They are extremely revered. So that's the anthropological background, but what Jung is realizing is there's something to that. But now, how do we apply that is the question. Then we had the theme of the crucifixion. And I cited that as sort of guiding me in my understanding of this text. Because we've seen opposites, and we'll go to the sheet in a second. We've seen all those opposites about power and the sun and evil. And then we've seen the opposites about Christianity. What he's doing, he's allowing all of these emotions and thoughts and feelings and experiences just to emerge without judging them as to their logical consistency. They're not logically consistent. That's why it's so difficult to read this material. But then he realizes they're all ingredients in the pie. But they're conflicting ingredients, and what I have to do is let myself be crucified on their contradiction until a higher synthesis emerges. That we've said several times, but I'm just sort of reviewing. Then we had the all that talk about the ship and being tossed about. That was nothing terribly new. It was just how emotionally upsetting it is to go through this process. It's like being on a ship in a severe storm.
It makes me wonder, you know, how much some of this stuff is affected by the, if he was affected by the, how he treated mental patients. Because if he would allow their dreams to come up, try to make sense out of all the chaos, and since there was a healing within there, if you could just work with it and discover it.
I'm sure.
I mean, it just it sounds so...
In a way, what he learned from them was to respect their process, and then what he learned about himself was to respect his process, and those two fertilized each other. And I think that was his... that was his way of working. There's, you know, all these little books. I enjoy reading these little books about people who knew him. One guy was saying, he was talking to Jung, and the phone rang, and it was the psychotic person on the phone. The person was saying, "Oh my God, the world is falling apart, and the house is turning upside down." And just said, "Well, go lay down on the floor for a while. It'll pass." Didn't interpret it, just took the experience at face value, as if it were a ship that was reeling in the ocean, and respected where people's experience was. we so soon jump in with criticism and interpretation and fix it and label it, and it's wrong or it's pathological. It's awful. That's their reality. He talked to that guy in his reality. You're on a ship that's sinking. Well, just get down the floor until it passes. So that's what we did last time. We ended then with something we'll return to. Picture 109, which I think is up there. But before we pick up, let's just do a quick review, and I'll try to tell you what I feel makes sense of everything we've done in about the last 2 or 3 months. Now, that stuff that little chart I passed around is a modified version of what I used to put up on the board. So, going back, really, did everyone get it, this little thing? Some of this is repeat, but I want to try to put it all in context to give it one summing up. We had, on the one hand, all this talk about the sun, how powerful he was, and then on the other hand, the sun was setting. We had all that talk about, you know, he is strong, he is powerful, and then he's weak. We've had the discussion about evil. Evil is good. It destroys your formulation. Remember that. And then, oops, but my soul is possessed by evil. So every idea he comes up with, which I'm going to call on the worldly pole, he ends up in a conflict. Then he goes to Christianity. That's when he started reading Thomas a Kempis. And that, you might say, is a counterpole to all the chaos from the worldly side. That's the spiritual side. Stable, righteous, good. But pretty soon he ran into a conflict there, which is Christianity leaves no room for the animal. So what he thought was the solution is another problem. So now he's got four opposites. Two on the worldly side, two on the Christian side. And I just marked down there the sentence that he realizes, even though Christianity is a problem, he can't leave it. He says all sorts of things in Christianity that maybe one would do well to keep. So he can't subscribe to it, and he can't throw it out. Then come the dead. While he's in, I think it was in the kitchen, the dead start processing through. Now this is where it starts to move positively, I think. Part of that he realizes, Christianity kills life. So part of those dead are the life that Christianity leaves no room for, the instinctual life. I just saw a dream this week of a theologian, of a dog who had been denied till it was almost dead. See, that's what Christianity does. It just kills the instincts. On the other hand, he also realizes there is much value in the dead. Again, a conflict. But the positive side of the dead then begins to form the resolution which starts to unfold. So that's the ancestor talk. Those values in the past which cannot be disregarded. One of the examples, which we don't see here, but you can think about in Jungian psychology, is alchemy. All those points of view of the alchemist, he realized we simply can't get rid of. But basically, I think the resolution starts with his talk about the ancestors. Then we have the crucifixion image, which we had last week, which was he is beginning to realize those two sides have to die and unite.
What two?
The four sides, the two on the worldly side and the polarity within Christianity. What he's come up with is a huge mess of conflict. But rather than say it's hopeless, he realizes through his fantasy that the resolution of this problem is a death of all previous understanding and allowing a new understanding to emerge from within the unconscious. That's the transcendent function. So what we're seeing here is his discovery of the transcendent function. I think just knowing that will help you put all of those chaotic elements previously into a context that he's now going to try to synthesize them. The reason you got confused is they were confusing. And what he is facing is that confusion and realizing that I've got to come up with a deeper point of view that contains them all. I can't sacrifice one for the other. How am I going to do that? He doesn't know, hence the image of death. Then the image of the tree. Now I'm anticipating where we'll be going this week and future weeks. The image of the tree, which is the growth that occurs as he gives up his conscious effort with the ingredients, and a process of growth starts, which will contain everything we've talked about up to now. He comes on the theme of the lowest. Compare that with all that talk about how he was God, how he's going to create God. And the theme will also come up, if not, I think we'll get to it this week, that it's not good or evil, it's good and evil. So that's the thread of development. Where does it go? I wrote two quotes on the right, which I think summarize where he's headed. Two statements which I think explain how everything I've said up to now fits together. The first quote, which now goes back to the comment he makes on this picture. He, which means the sacred figure, can be born only through the spirit of men as the conceiving womb of God. That, I think, resolves everything. So, look ahead, look for the sentence that contains the big statement. I think this is the one. What does it mean? It's, in Jungian jargon, a statement of individuation. Individuation means that I take my sacred potential and I make it real in time and space. That sacred potential in dreams is symbolized in religious imagery. So that's how he resolves the problem of Christianity. You have to take its imagery seriously, but you have to recast the level in which you take it seriously. That resolves the split between Christianity as a value and Christianity as a repressive force. It's a value if you take it inside. It is not a repressive force if you take it inside. By taking it inside, I mean live the meaning of the imagery in your dreams, which is a reflection of the Christian tradition. Some of you heard me say, I work with folks who have described themselves as recovering Catholics, and they literally long for the Mass, but they can't go back anymore. And when they discover why they're here on the earth and they begin living it, they dream they're in the Mass. So that life becomes the Mass. They have not given up the desire for the Mass, but they have found a new level in which to satisfy. That's one way of understanding that statement. And when you do that, all of the things that which we have seen up to now as contradictory fall into place. You need all the consciousness in the world. That's the sun. You need your ego and your power, but you don't use it for its own ends. You use it to bring forth the meaning of that imagery. You need evil in the sense you have to have the strength to destroy your previous past attitudes. You have to slay God in the sense that you slay your previous understanding of God. You're creating a new understanding of God. So that idea that he's moving towards, which doesn't come for a while yet, I think contains all of the confusing thoughts we've entertained while we've been sitting here. He finds a way to honor them, but to redefine their level of truth. And that's individuation. Another way, another sentence which I thought puts it in slightly more religious terms, I also wrote there to the right, I prepare the way for God's doing. But that God is a different understanding of God than has existed up to now. And if you don't believe me, try discussing this with a theologian. So he really, I feel, is moving Christianity forward, or moving religion forward, by finding a new level that it applies to. And it really is, you know, it is apropos of the people who make history. It's really not that far off from Teilhard de Chardin, who said, we need a new definition of holiness. These people knew that Christianity needs to evolve, or religion needs to evolve. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that we need a religionless Christianity. Same idea. They're not giving it up, but they're saying it needs to be re-understood. And Jung's re-understanding puts it in the fulfillment of your deepest inner voice. So, I don't know if that helps you or not, but I think if you can keep the big picture in mind where we're going, we're looking at all the ingredients of individuation. He doesn't have that word yet. He doesn't use that word yet. But it will give you a sort of a jigsaw puzzle outline in which to put all the pieces so that they don't seem so ridiculously unrelated and chaotic. And then we left off that. And those of you who did the Grail, after this series of developments that I marked there in the center, we get Parsifal. What does Parsifal do? But redefine what Christianity is. We'll talk about that when we get to it. Okay. So 298, we stopped in hell, second column, and we said we'd review a little bit. The full, there at the bottom, near the bottom of 298, second column, we are in hell. But of course, you haven't noticed it yet. I didn't realize until the second year of my time here that the director is the devil. You mean the professor? That sounds incredible. So, in other words, the intellect can't grasp this process and is highly destructive to it. Just when I was playing around with this stuff, I came across the review in Psychology Today of the Red Book, completely trashed it. It was just nonsense. See, that linear mind can't work with the chaos of imagery. And the chaos of imagery is what gives birth to the future, and so that linear mind kills growth. I think it's a terrible irony that psychology is that poisonous to growth, has become that poisonous to growth. Now, the fool, which I didn't understand last week until I went through this. You're an ignoramus. I was supposed to marry the mother of God long ago, but the professor, that devil, has her in his power. Every evening when the sun goes down, he gets her with child. In the morning before sunrise, she gives birth to him. Then all the devils come together and kill the child in a gruesome manner. I distinctly hear his cries. Now, what I understand now by Mary, the mother of God, is that we become responsible for the rebirth of the God image. And another way to say what I've just said for the last 15 minutes is, this is the rebirth of the God image. Finding a new way to understand what God is about.
You say we become responsible?
Yeah, we become the womb, he says later there in, I marked on that quote on page 299, we become the womb for the transformation of God. Our inner struggle, which carries this conflict and gives birth to it, is the womb that we need to connect with. That's how I understand Mary, the mother of God.
From the word that means the sea,
Mare.
And
it's
like the unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think he means Mary here. So that would be the mother of Christ. Mm-hmm. And there is no mother of God in Judaism, as far as I know. So he's really addressing a lack within the religious tradition itself. If there's no mother of God, how can you rebirth God? Because the mother is what gives birth. So that little statement is an extreme criticism of patriarchal religion. Why are we so static? Because we have no built-in mechanism of the birth of God.
I'm curious what the Greeks, you know, how they go back. Where does it start? Does it start with a woman? I think it starts with a woman.
I don't know. If I remember, we'll get to it in a footnote. In the Orphics, I believe Night is a woman.
Night.
And whoever it is lays a seed in her, mm-hmm. and she gives birth to Eros.
Yeah, we just read that.
Yeah, it's in here. So, yeah, they would still have it. See, we start with God, but even the Greeks go back to where God is born. And it's Eros that creates. Now, and so this picture has the caption, footnote 193, the man of matter rises up. See where I am, footnote 193? The man of matter rises up too far in the world of the spirits, but there the spirit of the heart pours through him with a golden ray. He falls with joy and disintegrates. The serpent who is evil could not remain in the world of spirits. we figure we still can't cut these down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's still broken.
No. So what do you reckon it means? The man of matter rises up too far in the world of spirit, of the spirits. But there the spirit of the heart bores through him with a golden ray. He falls with joy and disintegrates. The serpent whose evil could not remain in the world of spirits. Very critical sentence, I think.
Well, I like what you said last week about the rising up too far,
yeah,
intuition.
Right.
But that intuition was necessary to give him a grasp of his path, and also it's through that intuition that he is struck like a spear by the golden ray, which is the spirit, which the spirit of the heart sort of activates,
mm-hmm,
a feeling attitude in him that allows,
yep,
for the entrance of the fourth thing, the lowest thing, to be included under the law of love.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was thinking that this golden ray reminded me of the spear that heals Amfortas as we come soon to the grail.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. That certainly makes sense.
And, you know, thereby that Eros is brought into life. And I had talked about that device, that decorative device, the quatrefoil.
The energy.
That four-lobed.
Oh.
That four-lobed shape.
Yeah.
That forms the heart of, well, this is Jung himself, his journal.
In that picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's his heart. And we talked about the quatrefoil being a main decorative device on the astrolabe.
I forget what the astrolabe is.
The astrolabe determines the position of the
stars. Oh, right, 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 right. Yes.
And we associate that with the function of Sophia. Because Sophia is the constellation of your fate, the pattern of your stars,
yeah,
the pattern of your fate. So, but that astrolabe has come from the Arab world, where science and Eros did not become separated.
Right.
And this too is Jung's goal.
Yeah.
But
well said.
Okay. I brought with me today a poem. It's an epic poem called The Daughter of the Moon, and it was written by a friend of mine, Bruce Jones. And there's an amazing parallel to Jung's image in his poem. The quatrefoil became an overall theme in his work. And Bruce himself was a man of science, you know, working in the computer world, but eventually turned, you know, to the world of the heart and poetry, and is working very much on that. And I just want to read a little excerpt.
Yeah, please.
And he says, "And four lines radiated from the very center of the four corners of the cosmos. Then, as if one era was giving way to the next."
One era.
"The vesica piscis waned," that's the Christian symbol, "until only the rayed quatrefoil remained. Grew brighter. I stand near the shore. The weighed quatrefoil takes the shape of an elegant instrument in my hands.
Wow.
Compass and sextant to bring me over deep water to the center where the clefts and crests of the cosmos meet and the four rays of the quatrefoil align with converging folds opening the hidden vessel, and the line that flows out creates countless stars. Looking up at the cosmos, feeling above me, I see the streaking meteorite." Now this And even in the text that we read last week, talking about the symbology of the sextant, of the astrolabe was the precursor to the sextant.
Right.
And here, he brings all those images to get there in Jung's own image
mm-hmm.
together. The
sure does.
The quatrefoil.
Yep.
And
the
center, the heart, the
mm-hmm.
stars, how they guide him. So I think it's a very interesting parallel.
Very, very.
To Jung's image.
That's powerful. Thank you. Okay, you happy with that? You confused? No? Yes?
Yeah. So that. So when he says the serpent who is evil, is that the fourth?
I think that's matter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Which is of the fourth,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But this ray allows for its inclusion, even though it can't
right.
stay in the world of intuition,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, because it is matter.
Right.
It does open him up to how it can be included.
Yeah. So that matter has taken on an independent power apart from the spirit. And we've got to reconnect it with the spirit. And that's another way of saying what he's doing here. Because this individuation process gives us, I don't think he knows it quite yet, this individuation process presents its images both to our mind and from synchronicity, from the material world. So that matter is reconnected with spirit. Spirit as the guiding capacity of the psyche.
Okay, so I was thinking that first part of that person, this man of matter rises up too far in the world of the spirit,
mm-hmm.
would be the concretistic, literal
yeah.
Interpretation.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The wrong level.
Yeah.
When you're in the intuition or the spirit
mm-hmm.
realm. And that,
say that again. I'm hearing concrete and instinct. I'm confused.
Well, they're the same. Oh, wait, no. You go ahead.
Intuition.
You go ahead.
I didn't say instinct. I said...
I'm sorry, intuition.
I just saw this, heading onwards towards what you were saying before in the summary, finding the new level of meaning on the right level. But the man of matter rises up too far, meaning we're mixing levels.
Right.
But matter got into the level of the spiritual or intuition.
Mm-hmm. A substitute for it, really.
So it was mixing that. So
mm-hmm.
that's why I said rising up too far.
Yep.
Okay. And then the spirit was able to bore through it, penetrate it. But then this last sentence, the serpent who is evil could not remain in the world of the spirit. It bugs me that serpent is equated with evil. I think it's just a matter of level again.
It's matter.
Is it because it's unredeemed matter that the serpent is representing here?
I'll tell you what I think. I'm not sure. That we have gotten to a point, and here I'm with you, Jane, that matter has achieved such a power over us. We want more, we build more, we make cities that have no relationship to our emotional being. We're just obsessed with more and more matter. So it's taken the power that the spirit used to have. And the problem is that it is not connected with genuine spirit. Meaning, we don't ask, what does this piece of land want to become? We tell it what it's going to be, the strip mall. Maybe you'd like to be a park. So there's this disconnect between our lust for matter and the guidance of the Spirit. And what he's saying is we've got to reconnect them again so that we realize the Spirit comes through matter. Because matter wants that union. And if matter has usurped the power of the Spirit really isn't working through it anymore. Or if matter has usurped the place that we used to give the Spirit isn't working anymore. Because the Spirit and matter want to be united, and the reason he calls matter evil, the serpent, which is matter, evil, is all the trouble our desires get us into. Namely, Tony Wolf, I think.
And you can see the serpent is coiled around his foot there a little bit.
Yes.
It circled it so
yes.
it could easily trip him
yes.
up.
And I think that's the background for his own personal life of everything we're talking about. He is working it out in his mind. I'm having this affair. There is to be guidance in it. Just to have the affair would be matter divorced from spirit. To have the affair consciously would be to be guided by the meaning of the affair. And that's what allows him to accept it. And if matter has usurped the place of the spirit, we no longer let matter guide us. But if we unite matter and spirit, we let our sexuality, we let our synchronicities give us the same information about our development that we let our dreams do.
But that makes sense with something I just read about how our collective thinking, our literal collective interpretation of our concretistic collective thinking has inhibited our ability to breathe spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And that just that sentence was that's not verbatim, but that idea just because we're so caught in it, you know, we're so caught in this collective container, you know, it's hard to get out of it and it's hard to think outside of it. You know, and that really you stop and catch yourself, oh my God, that was another where it's so pervasive that you know, we can't even breathe with spirit.
Absolutely. You know, when I was in divinity school, this guy gave $20 million to the school for a new building. Students said, we don't need a new building. President said, we don't need a new building. We need scholarship money. President was fired. We got the new building. See what I mean? That's matter taking the place of spirit in a spiritual institution. That's the way we work. And he puts this, you always have to remember, this is the unconscious speaking, you know, it comes up in this weird language, then we got to try to figure out how would we say that to our brain. So I've just tried to interpret the odd way of phrasing it into a linear framework. And I think the other thing which you probably know, but maybe can forget, you might say, well, that's spirit and matter, or that's individuation, but he didn't know spirit and matter or individuation at this point. These are the ideas coming up that he later distilled into his theory. Is that better, worse? Okay.
I think a little bit different, but I think it still fits. I was thinking of what was happening in history at that time was the build-up of the World War I, basically. And I don't know so much about the history of World War I, but like World War II had a lot to do with we are going to improve the world, where the spiritual idea, perfectionism and things, and that constellated a lot of evil.
Yeah.
It's like as you try to flip that up, then the evil brought down into matter and horrible things happen.
absolutely. I think with World War One, remember, only 38 years prior was the telephone invented. So technology was putting this power in human hands, and what's the first thing we did with it? Kill 20 million people. You could also read matter as technological power. So yes, it applies both to his love life and to the obsession with machinery and material and the power that material science has put in our hands as matter. And you know, I think the subtext behind this is matter has assumed too much importance, but we can't get rid of it. Yet, look at its destructive power. I see that in my marriage. I see that in world history. How do we live with matter and put it in its proper proportion? We do that by realizing matter has a spiritual power. And that's what is striking his heart.
And that's where the astrolabe comes.
And I think it's the that if you know you think, oh, if I or maybe you don't think, but one might think, well, if I have more material, I'll be happier. And in a sense, you have to have material because it's one of the ways that the psyche speaks to us. And if you are in dialogue with the message coming to you through that material, by material I mean physical possessions, sexuality, power, things of the world, we find that that message humanizes the desire for that matter. That matter will break itself, BR. A.K.E. There's a break within matter, which is meaning. Does this make sense?
Say it again.
There's he's wrestling with this thing. Oh my God, I have this physical desire for this woman, and I think you're right too, Anne. He's also looking at the world stage and saying, it's machines that are conducting this war. It's machines that have given this war its horrifically powerful and destructive capacity. That's all matter. And you, so the Christian solution is, well, you transcend matter. But that didn't stop it. So he's saying, so how do we respect the power that we have to use the material world to build our own plans, and how do we respect our body's desires without getting destructive? And what he's realizing is that the psyche speaks through matter just as much as it does through dreams. And if you're working with the material world in your life symbolically, that gives a built-in way to keep the material world in its proper proportion. It's when you don't see the symbolic aspect of matter that you get greedy beyond measure. Matter itself is neither good nor bad. It's when you don't see its meaning, then you want more of it. When you see its meaning, you need a certain amount of it. And so that's spirit and matter. And I think that's what this cryptic sentence is getting at. Matter rising up too far in the world of spirits means matter has taken on a spiritual power because it substitutes for a relationship to the spirit. And if you have a relationship to the spirit in matter, you are relating to matter in the proper way. And the devil won't allow itself to be excluded from life. So you either get, if you're going to be true to your desire, you either are driven to it, driven by it, to excess, or you find the spirit in it and you're able to relate to it in the proper way. Is this making any sense?
I just like the, you said, the spirit of the heart, so that goes along
yeah.
with the emotion.
Yeah.
That would be
key. In a way, it might help to see how this is a response to Freud. See, Freud talks about instinct. Well, if, you know, one amount of instinctual satisfaction is good, why wouldn't two times that be better? What puts in the limit? Well, for Freud, it's a superego. But that's just morality. And Jung is saying, no, there's a built-in limiting factor in instinct, in desire for matter, in possessiveness, and that's the spirit. And if you can see that your dreams are both occurring inside you and in the material world, you relate to the material world much differently. You might say, think of Michelangelo who looks at the stone and says, what statue is in there? See what I mean?
For me, this is one of the most important images we've had.
It really starts to synthesize now. And if you look at the pictures that we've come up with, this is the first time we have really coherent monoliths, which means integration is starting to occur. Monoliths.
And he appears as a man for the first time in his images. Well, no, it isn't. He was in there before, in the very beginning, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As the anchorite, mm-hmm. or wasn't he like a...
He was in those images with Elijah and Samuel.
Right, right.
He
was in the image when the egg was
fire coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's the first time that the spirit has penetrated the core. I mean, spirit and matter. Spirit has penetrated the core of the heart.
Well,
the central
mandala. You could say for the first time his creative forces are shown within his body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know, remember that uncomfortable guy we had in here for a while? Every time I would talk about this, he'd say, well, you're just saying you go out and have sex and things like that. A guy like that doesn't realize that if you honor your desires and your imagery, they will balance each other. They think if you give way to desire, well, you'll just screw anybody you'll get your hands on. Why not? It's fun. And so two lovers is as much, twice as much fun as one. And three is three times as exciting as one. But what they don't realize is how that imagery balances them out. And that physical attraction carries as much a challenge to understand it as does any dream image. So you can't go to excess if you're living your relationship to desires for the material world consciously. You certainly can stray from the traditional Judeo-Christian no. But you hit another limiting factor, which is not right or wrong, but meaning. What of these activities brings you meaning? Let's take a break. A little light talk for Thursday afternoon.